what I was going to say.
So actually there's a sort of built-in mechanism that keeps the conference focused to kind of what have you done that's new.
Yeah.
That you know.
There is. Now, some conferences are better at that than others. And those early Gordon conferences had a guy named Dick Ogg from Stanford. Dick was amazingly able. He was a very good physical chemist. And he could ask questions which were very penetrating. He was one of the people there who, he wasn't mean, but he was wise. And he asked you questions which made you wish you weren't up there. Because some conferences don't have even a single person like that. And then they're sort of dull. I've been to some that are dull. Nobody's there. But if you have, and most of the inorganic conferences that I've been to, there's usually one or two people that'll initiate that. And as soon as it gets going, boy, then they love it. Then everybody jumps in.
If you, after you've been going, how many people at a conference might have been, if there's 100 people in the room, how many of them might have been at 10 previous conferences? And how many might have been at none?
Well, in recent years, people have been making an effort to provide money to help young professors who had never been to a conference. And there may be 100 participants or maybe 25 that haven't been to a conference before. There may be as many as 5 or 6 that have been to 10 conferences. And so when I almost always went, in fact, this is going to be the first year I've missed in many, many years. And I think, well, we've been to all the conferences. Maybe we've missed 5 since 1951.
Under the title of
inorganic
chemistry. Yes.
Been to a few other ones as well, but we always went to the inorganic one. And they wanted me to, I have a letter in my desk from the guy who was this year's chairman, saying he didn't see my name on his list. And he wanted to be sure I was going to come. Well, I'm not going to come. I've got to go to another meeting. I had to write and tell him I won't. But that's... we were two that went to a lot of them.
You're saying, Bob, that you've been to about 45 out of 50.
Well, let's say 40 out of 50.
Okay. Yeah. But how many other conferences do you suppose have that level of continuity in someone in the conference? Is this unique, or is it what?
I don't know. I don't know that much about the other conferences. Some of them, I think it is. I think in some of the ones, I would imagine that in polymers, we're very plastic.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that have been there for a long time. I know some of them, like Jake Beagleisen and nuclear stuff. And I know that there's some people, but I think I would have to look at the attendance sheets to tell about that.
Now, in 51, your conference was where?
New Hampton.
And you were the only people in the college, this conference?
That's right.
In last year, where were you?
We were at Solvay Regina in Rhode Island.
And were you the only people in the college?
No, there was another conference there too last year.
But only two?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering that...
They got a lot of different sites. They got sites overseas.
The thing is highly disaggregated. There's no reason that you need ever know anything at all about the polymer conference, as it were.
That's right. That's right. It used to be different. There were maybe 15 conferences, maybe as many as 30 the year that I went to. There were 30 the first year. Maybe there were 20 conferences at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But then...
But they were spread among 20 colleges.
Yeah. Or maybe 15. Some of them had two conferences. but I guess New Hampton didn't have room for more than one conference at a time, but it had conferences on all summer. But they liked the money, and so they changed things and got so they could have more than one conference. But then they gave them up when they got rich and famous. but the Gordon conferences saved a lot of these colleges from financial ruin, because it provided a utilization of their facilities, and the Gordon conferences built buildings for them and stuff like that. And man, they needed that. They saved them.
Yes. Going to that first conference again, there's 100 people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Are they all men?
Yes, they were.
Is there a moderator? People just jump up and
shout a question? Oh, yeah, there's a moderator. There's a man who was supposed to call on people and stuff. But when you got a very vigorous discussion, they didn't always follow Robert's rules of order. They were shouting at each other. And they didn't think that was too bad, because people were really interested.
Right. And the chairman is you get to the conference by the chairman's invitation.
That is correct. Well, you send an application to the chairman, and he or she has the right to either admit you or not admit you. If the conference doesn't have a surplus of invitations, you usually take everybody that applies. We have had a couple of inorganic conferences in recent years where they had 160 people apply, and they could admit as many as 120 at the outside. Crowd in the place as much as you could. So 40 of them didn't get to go. Mm-hmm. That's the chairman's decision.
Mm-hmm. Who chooses the chairman?
He or she is elected.
By?
The conference the preceding year.
A vote of the 100 people there?
Yeah. We elect, they select the chairman from, I guess, usually it has to be somebody in that, as for always, I'm not sure I can say always, it was usually somebody in the year, in the room that year. They would put up two or three people, and then they would have a written ballot. These people had to leave the room, and people would talk about them, and outline their qualifications and stuff, then you'd have a vote.
So this was an honor to be competed for?
I guess, in a sense that it was a job. It's a hard job. It used to be even harder because you had to raise money. In fact, that's something that I think I'd like to mention.
Just stay, if you would, on the... I mean, if there's... one thing that makes the job difficult is you may volunteer to do it and your peers may say, I don't want you. That is, in the vote, you're voted down.
Yeah, you don't volunteer. They ask you if you'll run.
Who?
They have a committee that is doing the selecting the nominees.
And that committee is...
It
itself is, comes from where?
It is, in the early days, I think the committee that took care of the second conference consisted of Fernie, who had been asked to organize it for inorganic chemistry, John Baylor, you know about him, Larry Quill, who was at Michigan State. These guys were sort of the grandfathers of the whole discipline. These guys were the ones who had pushed inorganic chemistry and knew the people and knew the subject.
But was the committee... When did you first get into the committee, or...
Well, I didn't get into the committee until after I had been chairman. The chairman, after these guys, later on, I think after these guys did this initially, they selected people for the second year, and then frequently the person, anyone who had been a chairman, was on this committee.
Mm-hmm. At some point, they moved to having vice chairs.
Well,
the vice chair all but automatically becomes chair the next year.
Yeah, they decided that raising money was a problem. And you can't do that if you start in November for a conference in July. You can't give invitations and stuff unless you have money in your pocket. So they started the vice chair business. Otherwise, you couldn't operate. And so all of these things evolved, but the first one was they used these older members of the profession who enjoyed a lot of respect and a lot of support, and they did the...
What you're describing there sounds very, very academic. Was the inorganic conference a very academic one always, or?
At first, well, let me address that question a little bit differently. George Parks was the first director of the conference, and he did a wonderful job when he started out, because money was always the problem. How do you get people there? The guy really has to be dedicated to want to spend his vacation and his dollars to get there. And George Parks went to, when he agreed to run these conferences as director, he went to the industry, to the leaders of industry, and asked each of them for $1,000. He asked 35 companies for $1,000. When he finished, he had $35,000. He was effective. And he was the guy who really made it possible, financially. The organization of the conferences is the thing that has been copied throughout the world now and makes the Gordon conferences essentially unique. That organization, I thought, came from Alex Cruikshank and Irene. It didn't. It came from the Gibson Island conferences from Neil Gordon. Mm-hmm. What he did was he said, we're going to meet from 8 in the morning until noon. Then you can have the afternoon off. We'll meet from 7 till 9 at night. Mm-hmm. That's what he did. People loved it. They loved having the afternoons off. The afternoons gave rise to a lot of talk about chemistry. People got involved in the morning in discussions and stuff, and it went on all afternoon. And that was one of the wonderful things about the conference, because you had these opportunities. You had a trapped group here, and you could talk to these people who were arguing with you. And it worked. And the the pattern was put in by Alex and Irene, which followed Neil Gordon's pattern almost precisely. But that wasn't easy, because there were people after the first year who thought that was not a good way to do it. They wanted to work in the afternoon and go home at night. But as time went on, people liked that model, and it has become really the signature pattern of the Gordon conferences.
Back to your 1951. You said 8 till noon. Well, were you being eaten for 4 hours?
No, there was another person. I was being eaten for an hour and a half.
Okay. And then they took a break to digest.
They took a break, a coffee break, and then they came back and ate somebody else.
And in the evening?
The evening there were two speakers as well. An hour and a half, it was 3 hours, yeah. 7 till 10.
Yeah. And in the afternoons, you're having slightly less formal discussion.
Yeah, you could go play tennis, right. You could go sailing. And that was the thing about New England. One of the things that was bad about the Gibson Island conferences was at Gibson Island, conferences were held at a very posh country club. And they didn't really like the people who came very well. Professors and young chemists could be very immature. A lot of them were. And as a matter of fact, I guess ultimately they left Gibson Island because they wouldn't keep them any longer. In New Hampshire, it worked pretty well. Alex still had, and George still had problems. You've probably read in this book that George mm-hmm. banned one guy from the conferences for life because he was shooting an arrow, the length of the hallway. He could have killed somebody. The guy was liquored up, and there were a few instances like that, but by and large, there was lots of horseplay, but there was not much hazardous stuff. When it got to be physically hazardous, they clamped down.
Can you talk about when wives changed into spouses?
Well, they didn't like to have women around at first. I didn't know any women that were inorganic chemists. I guess the first woman that was an inorganic chemist that I interacted with was, well, I guess the first one was probably Mary Good. And I was then editor of Inorganic Chemistry. That was about 1959, I guess. And 59 to 60. And Mary sent me a paper. She was a professor at Louisiana State at Baton Rouge. I think that's where she was. Anyway, she was in Louisiana. And I sent it back to her and would accept it, provided she made certain changes, which she did, but I learned later that she wasn't happy about making those changes, but she didn't want to get involved. And that was, there weren't very many women in chemistry at that time. I had a Catholic nun at the University of Michigan who came to me and wanted to work with me. And I had had no women graduate students up to that point. And I could justify that to myself by saying that, well, the stuff I was doing involved such things as getting loads of liquid nitrogen, moving heavy things around and so on, that I thought women would have trouble with. And this was a job for men. The nun came, her name was Sue Fleming, Sister Sue. She came to me and asked me if she'd work with me. And I said, well, I'd have to think about this, because it was a hazardous activity. And I was concerned about her habit, which I thought could catch on fire, burners and all that kind of stuff. And I'd have to think about it. Well, then she came back maybe a week later. Dr. Perry, can I work with you? And I began to hem and haw. She said, yes or no? Can I work with you? And I said, yes. And she was the first woman that I had as a graduate student. She was wonderful. She didn't need to worry about lifting things. There were always a guy lined up to it. She just whistled and they'd come and do what you wanted done. And then I had quite a number of women. One of the women that I had is Karen, was a lady named Karen Morse. I had both she and her husband as graduate students. In fact, I told them that I arranged the whole thing. I put them in the same lab together. She is now the president of Western Washington University. She's done wonderful things. And I've had a number of women. I had several women graduate students here.
Was it in the Gordon Research Conferences, if it was all men in the room, it wasn't was it ever an explicit issue, or did one day it was just a woman in the room?
It's just a woman. Mm-hmm. It never became a formal issue, but you see, it was becoming something that universities were talking about. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, hey, we need to invite this lady to give this talk. She's doing good work here. And that was the way it started. People didn't ever say that we've got to get a woman it was always, here is good work being done by this chemist, and it just so happens that she's a woman.
What about change with time and the social pattern of the day? And families and so on, has it
well, really, they always changed? Did have families, they could have wives and families, but they usually lived off-site. There were lots of cabins and semi-resorts around the New Hampshire side, and families would frequently live there, and the man would come over in the morning and go to the meetings. He would play with the family in the afternoon, and then he'd put the kids to bed at night, and he went back to work. And that, there were a lot of people that did that.
So there's some people living in the college, some people not living in the
college. That's right. You didn't have to live in the college.
How did that experience work for you? The first few you went to, your afternoons, you were butting it around with other young junior faculty, and then at some point?
Well, I didn't... I've taken my wife to some of those, but she didn't really like that as much as some other things we did, and so she would go with me once in a while, but she frequently would not want to work, not want to go.
If the, could you chart the fraction of participants who were single for the conference as opposed to family?
Well, was it noticeable in the sense that in the afternoons the people who were there with family would disappear and the others would still be around and would play
some
sports?
Some of them would come over, for example, when the conference was at Brewster. The conferences were at Brewster Academy. People and families were out on that lake because Brewster Academy had boats and places to swim and all that stuff. And the families came over and they could use the thing because they were in the conference. The guy showed his badge and they're in. And that was... But in New Hampton was a tennis place, and people who played tennis would play tennis a lot in the afternoon. There was golf nearby, but tennis was the big thing, and they had the New Hampshire tennis matches in the summer at New Hampton. Sometimes when conferences were there. Mm-hmm. In fact, one year, Gil Haight and Harry Gray won the New Hampshire championship. And after that, they barred them from participating.
Okay. Go back to 51. You're the young assistant professor. Are there a lot of white-haired old geezers in the room?
No, there weren't. There were, these guys weren't even white-haired yet. That's when Bernie and Quill and Baylor, let's see, 51. Well, Baylor was a relatively, well, he was below 50, I think, himself. Maybe 20 years older than I was, so... He's below 50. And inorganic had been sort of a non-entity in the chemical world before that time. And it was taught out of a book that you had to memorize the elements in the table and what color it was, and et cetera. Which is very bad. And starting with people like Baylor and Bernidius and Quill, they began to pull away from this quite a bit. And then ultimately, we got the people like Basolo and a lot of others. The pull was strongly away from that kind of thing, is systematic in organic chemistry.
Yeah. If the conference last year's inorganic conference, what was the age distribution of the group?
Well, there were about, I would guess, about 20 people that were young. They made a real effort to get them. I want to come back to this in the distribution of people to industry versus academia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The distribution was maybe 20 of the young folks, and I think there had about 120 last year. And then there were people fairly evenly distributed in the from the about 25 up to 45 or to 50, and then it began to fall off pretty fast. And you finally got to Basolo and I, who were in our 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a completely a young man's game. People like to go, and scientifically they are very useful.
So it's like the rest of science in the sense that the conference reflects science in that it's age brings certain benefits, but youth has plenty of benefits too.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. The industry and academe, the back in 1951 or those early conferences.
It was industry. They had made the point, we'll give George Parks $1,000, and he said, I will give you guys then for your $1,000, you can send one of your people to the conference that you pick.
And we'll to each conference?
Well, okay. if they're talking, if they're going to give $1,000 to one that they're interested in, and he wasn't going to restrict us to, because they had to pay, industry had to pay the person's expenses. They had to pay his transportation and his registration fees and all that stuff. And I don't remember that they actually said they can, there may have been a limit of how many conferences they could send a person to.